Hello and welcome to Lunch with Leon. You've already heard about my special guest this week, I'm sure, because he's famous on television, on radio, of course in the press, and indeed as an author. He's Christian Wolmar, the noted railway historian and author, one-time London mayoral hopeful, as well as a commentator on the wider public transport scene across the world. He's written many books, several of them including The Subterranean Railway, Fire and Storm, How the Railways Transformed Britain, and The Edge of the World, the story of the Trans-Siberian Railway, are extremely well known. He also wrote a book, Driverless Cars, On a Road to Nowhere, which we talked about over lunch. But the real reason to invite Christian on for lunch this time is not only because he's good company and he's got some good views about many aspects of transport, is because, as an author, he's also got a new book out about Crossrail. So, Christian, I've really enjoyed your new book. So this is a new version of your 2018 Crossrail book with some extra information, especially at the end, right?
Yes, well, I was foolish enough to write a book on Crossrail that was supposed to come out in November 2018, which was perfect timing for when the railway opened in December 2018. And, you know, it was absolutely perfectly timed. And I fulfilled my bit of the bargain by completing the manuscript in August and getting it published in November. But, of course, by then, and I managed to squeeze it in at the end of this first edition of the book, that it wasn't going to happen in 2018 and probably not going to happen in 2019. So the book didn't sell enormously well, but excitingly, the publishers agreed to do a paperback version, which allowed me to do something very interesting, Leon, which was that I went back to all these people. I'd spent much of 2018 in Canary Wharf in the Crossrail offices, hearing about how it was going to be on time and on budget, but, you know, also hearing about all the difficulties of building such a railway and meeting some very interesting people. And to be honest, I liked nearly all of them. I thought they were an amazing bunch of people, very capable, very thoughtful. And for a while, I actually drank the Kool-Aid. I actually thought, yeah, you know, this looks difficult, but it's, you know, I'm really not sure about it. And then in June 2018, I had my eureka moment, rather a couple of months before they threw the towel in, which was I went to Paddington Station, the Crossrail station, and there were 500 people working there in their orange suits. The platform doors had a few of them had been delivered, but they weren't all there. The escalators were in bits. There was equipment everywhere. There were lots of rooms kind of filled with stuff. And I thought, this is not going to happen. And I remember talking to a senior executive at the time saying, look, are you really sure this is happening? Oh, yeah, we're 80% sure this is going to open on time. And in fact, Leon, and so this made the interesting part of the second edition of the book, you know, what on earth went wrong? Quite interesting, but particularly interesting is how could they believe in June 2018 that this project was, in the words of Boris Johnson, up and ready to go in December 2018 and open on time on budget? That is fascinating.
So, of course, in my time in TfL, I never had my fingers anywhere near Crossrail, but it was going on around me. And if you saw that 6 months before the opening, you would have thought quite a lot of very expert professional people, experts on big projects, construction projects, experts on railways generally, would also have spotted that.
Yes, you would. And indeed, one of the people I later interviewed was Mark Wilde, who is now the chief executive of the project, but was actually on the board at the time. And he says that looking back, he thinks that 99 out of 100 people working there knew that the Emperor had no clothes and it wasn't going to happen. But just as with the Emperor, nobody dared to put their hand up and say, actually, we don't think this is feasible. But when you look at the practicalities, for example, it's taken more than a year to test out the trains. They were thinking they could test out the trains, which were not particularly ready, actually. There were some of them weren't ready, in 12 weeks, carry out the whole process and then carry out The testing and then the trial running, which is operating to a timetable, and then trial operations, which is getting a couple of thousand people into a train and getting the train to break down in the middle of tunnels and evacuating and all that kind of stuff. They thought that could be done in 12 weeks. It just wasn't feasible in any respect. It just couldn't happen. So when they went to Sadiq in August 2018, they gave this PowerPoint presentation, which made it utterly clear that, you know, this was nowhere near ready and would take at least a year, if not, and it's in fact now taken 3 years before it could open. So the book details some of that. I can't say I've got to the absolute bottom of how these people could fool themselves, but I think it's a mixture of emperor's new clothes, the wrong atmosphere amongst senior managers, the sheer complexity of the task, the uniqueness of the task. This is Britain's first digital railway, and just a failure of any of the outsiders, and I include the TfL board in this, and the department, and the Jacobs, who were the kind of public representative. All of them should have been shouting louder that this was not going to happen.
No. One of the things, and you don't draw it out explicitly in the book, but I thought, is that, of course, Crossrail was born when TfL was not really trusted by the Department for Transport. So we ended up with this really cumbersome dual sponsorship of the project. And there were several other things in there too, which is, it's the same reason why, that's why the government insisted there was an independent investment program advisory group drawn from outside, because it wasn't sure, it wasn't confident. But of course, over the period, certainly of the period that ran through to the period of Peter Hendy being commissioner, TfL became much more trusted in the eyes of the government. It became more trusted in the eyes of Boris. And I think a sceptical City Hall realised that TfL was probably one of the best delivery machines that it had got. But the drawback is, by then, is the tunnels were being dug and the thing was literally set in stone. And they were stuck with the alignment, they were stuck with the construction, they were stuck with the process, they were stuck with the contractors. They had to find a way of financing the trains. And it seems to me that, and you do say this in the book very clearly, that mega projects have a habit of having all these sorts of problems, don't they?
Yes. I mean, I agree. There shouldn't have been two sponsors. One of the things that Andy Byford did when he came in as a commissioner a year or so ago, he said, we want total control of this project and it's going to go to TfL, and they actually abolished the Crossrail board and so on. And I think that was an excellent move. But you need somebody like him who is prepared, and he does this, to talk every day to Mark Wilde and the team to ensure that there is progress. And you know, that was lacking because of this kind of split between the department and TfL of who was in charge of the project. So I totally agree. Yes, mega projects do tend to overrun and go over budget, and partly because when the business case for them is put, it's always rather optimistic. So there is something called optimism bias, as you know. But also, you know, the sheer difficulty and complexity of carrying out these undertakings inevitably leads to cost overruns. But you know, Leon, this one's about 25% over budget, and okay, it's 3 years late, but you know, it's all going to get forgotten about. I mean that's the important thing to say about this, and you can't, I can't emphasize this enough. You know, I was on a press trip the other day, and of course I've been to the tunnels lots of times, but most of the other journalists hadn't, and they were just wowed by this. My gosh, you know, this is just a fantastic project. And it is. It's built on a completely different scale. It's not like an underground line, as you know. I mean, the tunnels are huge, much bigger, not just the running tunnels, but the passageways for people. You never feel cramped. It all has this wonderful glass-reinforced concrete, which is very soft. The lighting is really well thought out. You know, there's lifts for people with disabilities, platform doors, air conditioning, and the 250-metre-long platforms, which just look amazing. You just want to kind of set up some sticks and turn them into a bowling alley, because like it would be great fun, you know. And you know, everything about it is so wonderful that this will be forgotten. I mean, you have to look at other big projects like, well, the Jubilee Line Extension. Who worries about that now? Or indeed, the British Library was a huge source of fuss and bother when it was being built. It was always going over budget and stuff. Now it's a wonderful venue that people just accept is a vital part of London's culture and infrastructure. So, you know, there is good news ahead. You know, the story of what went wrong and, you know, how it happened needed to be told. And so my book is, in a way, two different books. It's a celebration of this project and a look at the history of how it happened. And it's also a kind of analysis of how something this big goes wrong.
That's really interesting, Christian. Now, one of the things you draw out in the book, of course, is that calling it the Elizabeth Line and having it masquerading as another underground line really undersells it for all the reasons you've said, not only the journey speeds, but also the architecture, the way in which speed at which people will be moved, the frequency of the trains and so on. This is more like an RER in Paris than it is an underground line, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's nothing like an underground line. I mean, you know, the diameter of the trains is completely different. You know, they're 50% wider. The tunnels are different. You know, the electrical system is overhead. And above all, there's a feeling of space down there. I mean, I'm sure you've been down to some of the tunnels. And there's just, you can feel relaxed there. And the lighting is just brilliant. You know, they have spent a bit of money on making it not just a functional railway. And I think that's important. And I think that's right. You know, whoever allowed that, something happened with the Jubilee Line extension, and they got away with it, rightly so. So the Jubilee Line extension is much nicer than the rest of the underground system. But this is a whole category higher and better. And just calling it the Elizabeth Line is such a tragic mistake. What was wrong with Crossrail? I know we have to pay homage to the Queen and whatever, but we could have done it in other ways. It just doesn't make sense at all, because people will, you know, particularly people coming from outside London or abroad, will think, oh, you know, shall I take the Bakerloo line or the Central line rather, or shall I take the Crossrail? And the answer is take the Crossrail. It's 11 minutes between, you know, Paddington and Liverpool Street. I mean, you know, the Central line must be half an hour between the two. It's just everything about it is completely different from the two.
I think there are some names that will always stick, hence the occasion to try and call Thameslink First Capital Connect. Well, the truth is, the passengers continued to call it Thameslink, and eventually it became Thameslink again. These names are stuck in the minds. And in the case of Crossrail, the project has been around for so long that Crossrail has spanned many generations. Now, a funny story I heard from within the department was that for many, very many years before the project was finally greenlit, the department had worked out it was actually cheaper to keep the project alive than it was to build it. Because, of course, it was occupying 50 or 100 people, drawing lines on maps and so on. And since half that money, or at least 47% of that money, comes back in tax and national insurance, and the balance, most of it gets spent that attracts VAT. So the government actually keeps recycling this money quite well. And one of the troubles about that...
Actually, you're touching on a much wider point there that I have tried in vain to get across. But that applies in a much bigger way to all these projects. I mean, when you're costing a project like HS2, to which I'm not a great fan, as you know, but if you're costing a project and you're saying, well, it's going to cost £100 billion, and then they say, well, hold on a sec, you know, 20% of the construction material is back with the Chancellor straight away, you know, probably out of £100 billion, probably a couple of billion, you know. And then, you know, again, 35, 40% of the wages will go back as national insurance and tax. So we need a new way of calculating the real cost of these things, a much more sophisticated way than just trying to dream up cost-benefit analysis, which are then greatly boosted in terms of the benefits so that they actually fit in with the business case. That's nonsense. What they should do is calculate the genuine cost over, say, a period of 5 years or 10 years in the way that you've just alluded to. And you would come up with very different answers about how much has actually been spent. I remember that during the Olympics, at one point they said, oh, we haven't costed in the VAT. So it's going to cost another billion. And you think, no. The VAT goes straight back to the exchequer. It's not a cost. But nevertheless, I'm sure you might remember that. They try to kind of add it as an extra cost. If it, no, that, it's completely tax neutral. It goes back.
Indeed.
And so I'm surprised that, you know, the construction companies or those, you know, the Department of Transport or whoever else hasn't got a more sophisticated measure of the genuine cost of these projects, which would take that into account.
I know. One of the things you touch on in the book, which I'm fascinated about, because in all of my time at TfL, we were always about 5 years away from financial sustainability. And the J hockey stick curve of the graph was always predicated on Crossrail revenue. Effectively, Crossrail is such a big project, it was going to be full on day one. And when all that revenue comes streaming in, then TfL's financial situation is miraculously transformed. And of course, it should have been open by now, as you allude in the book. We should be now up at the forecast numbers by 20. Yeah, we should have been there by now. And so there's two problems. Firstly, it's late, and that money will never be recovered because it didn't get spent. It got spent on something else, so it didn't get spent. So it's already years late. But COVID has brought us something else, and it's a brave person now to say that Crossrail will be full on day one, because even in the peak hours, nothing is full at the moment. You know the numbers as well as I do. I'm pretty sure that even in the best possible circumstances, 15% of public transport's market has gone for good. And that's the incremental effect of everything from home deliveries to not coming to the office 5 days a week. So 15% of it's gone forever. When I'm feeling optimistic, I'd like to think that most of that 15% is in the peak hour, and therefore we'll have a flatter peak, and therefore we'll run more efficiently because the day is flatter than it currently is. But it will almost certainly not transform TfL's financial fortunes at the scale and speed that it once was thought of. Is that a fair summary?
No, I think that's right, and I agree with you about some of it never coming back. But you have to look at the other side of the equation as well, which is, you know, can you bring in people? Can you actually market public transport? And funny enough, I've just been writing today the regular column I do for Railway Magazine, and I've been comparing the performance of LNER on the East Coast with Avanti on the West Coast. And lo and behold, the latest statistics we have are that while Avanti has only managed to get to about 57% of pre-COVID levels, LNER had got to 90%. And how had it done this? It'd done this by good marketing, with initiatives, and crucially by daring to invest in things because it's not in the private sector, it's in the public sector, and it doesn't have an owning group saying, oh, you can't spend that, we're not going to get a rate of return on it. But it's actually been thinking sort of medium to long term, and it's done initiatives like you can now book tickets 6 months in advance, whereas in the past you could only book them 12 weeks in advance. The problem being that the 12 week thing is that the timetable is only emerges from Network Rail every 12 weeks in advance, so the trains might not run. Well, what do you do? You say, well, we'll guarantee you, we'll either refund you the money for your service, or we'll transfer you to another train. And lo and behold, we can book you 6 months in advance. It might not happen, but it's very unlikely. And if so, you will not be out of pocket or inconvenienced. Now, that sort of thing, I don't know how that translates to a thing like Crossrail, but I think there are lots of ways you can market Crossrail merely by the fact of getting people on it and just showing what it is, and that it's a whole different degree. So, for example, if you live in Southall and you want to get up to town, it will take you 20-odd minutes as opposed to 45-50, and you won't have to change. You can get off right in the middle of Tottenham Court Road or Bond Street, which actually is Oxford Circus, but they didn't call it that because it doesn't link with the station. So, yeah, this is transformational, and what we need is a marketing campaign. But will TfL, with its current constraints, be allowed to actually have a marketing campaign for it? Because that's what is needed.
My last thought on your book which I was really interested in. You talk very expertly about the complications of running multiple different signalling systems in order to cope with the prevailing situation on the west, in the tunnels, in the east, and on the Heathrow spur. And of course, a lot of the unknown in this project has been about the coexistence of those signalling systems inside a single train. The one that I was never able to persuade anybody to talk about as an explanation is that I think when you're explaining to the general public, I think people assume that if you buy software, it works perfectly out of the box, because that's how you buy a washing machine or a fridge. Frankly, that's how you buy a car. You don't expect the car to be going back to the garage every week for software upgrades and so on. It's supposed to work out of the box. But in the case of railway signaling in particular, it is an iterative process, and there's quite a lot of work. And the one thing I couldn't ever persuade anybody to try and say to the public is, look, software, it gets created and it gets installed. And if you're lucky, there might be 100,000 bugs for us to work through. And if we're unlucky, there might be 1 million bugs for us to work through. And when you ask me for when we're going to be finished, I can't tell you, because until I know whether we've got 1 million bugs or 100,000 bugs, I can't tell you. And that's because the way in which software is created is you try it, you make some adjustments, you see if those adjustments work, you test them. And as you describe in the book, over this trial running period, the software drops have been coming through so that there's increased functionality and increased reliability. And I don't think the public is too stupid to understand that. I think you could make a perfectly cogent argument that says, as far as the software is concerned, we might be lucky. On the other hand, we might be unlucky. And the difference between the two might be 12 months, 18 months. Because I think the public might appreciate that honesty. What do you think?
Yes, I think part of the problem is that I'm not sure that the project team was honest with itself over this, because, you know, it wasn't only the signaling system, and that was a problem, because there were three different types. You can even say it's four, because the National Rail system on one side is slightly different from on the other side. But anyway, but it's not only that, Leon, that it is a fact that this is a digital railway. What does that mean? Well, it means that absolutely everything can be controlled by computer, so and monitored by computer. And, you know, even very small kind of problems with either the software or sometimes with the hardware can cause, you know, enormous difficulties. I think we have to slightly ask whether that is wise, actually, whether just as in the old days we used to have mainframe computers and then we all got laptops, maybe the idea of integrating everything in that way creates more problems than it solves. You know, is the enormous complexity of signaling partly the result of over-specifying safety and over-specifying kind of various aspects of it that actually it might be better to be simpler? But I mean, I'm not a software expert, but it just strikes me that this whole software issue, which I think has been responsible for most of the delays, has been got out of hand, and nobody understands it. Nobody understands systems integration, apart from a few very, very techie people. But essentially, systems integration is the talent of the future. If you have any children who want to work in something, get them working in systems integration, because that has a big future.
I know. So, Christian, we could talk all day about your book on Crossrail, but there's one or two other things going on. Since you and I met last, a couple of interesting things have happened. The good thing is we've got a highway code now that gives walking and cycling a proper place in the road user hierarchy, which is something I know you've been campaigning for and I've been very keen for a long time. And I'm delighted now that it's far less the case now that motorized vehicles have some sort of priority based on their size and speed, which is great. But on the other hand, I don't know how you feel about this, but I am distraught to see the post-COVID car-led recovery, which has accidentally got itself hitched to the zero emission cavalcade, because now, on the back of a government saying don't use public transport, you might catch COVID, we've got a situation where, frankly, you can lease an electric car for 3 years. If it's your company, that's VAT and corporation tax you won't be paying. The benefit in kind for the use of a company car that's an EV is just 1%, and it only costs £11 to fill it up to go 200 miles. So, on the one hand, great for walking and cycling. I'm really pleased to see the government make that move. On the other side, it seems to me to have triggered a car-led post-COVID recovery. It's self-evident to me that one day the 38 billion worth of fuel duty, vehicle excise duty, and all the other stuff that electric vehicles are exempt from, that problem will come home to roost in the Treasury.
Well, you absolutely know that, you know, yes, that there is only one solution to this, and it's road pricing. And, you know, you and I and everybody in the industry knows that ultimately this has to happen. And look, when I first got a job as transport correspondent at The Independent in 1993, I think it was, I flew off to Oslo and Gothenburg with the then Secretary of State, John McGregor, who was looking at road pricing ideas and the fact that Oslo had a congestion charge sort of thing. And Gothenburg, they were doing some tests on what would now be very primitive kit. But and I remember asking on the plane back, do you think this is possible? I said, oh, well, you know, there'll be a lot of opposition. And of course, the idea just died the death. And nearly 30 years on, we are hardly anywhere closer, although they're beginning to kind of realise that this loss of this £38 billion is going to blow a hole in it. But it is inevitable, isn't it? I mean, what, you know, there is an externality cost to road use, and it's a pretty heavy one. And how do we recoup that? Well, through road pricing is the only sensible way to do it. Let me add something else there that you've touched on that infuriates me, is that the messaging about public transport has been so wrong, and that will take quite a long time to recover from. I mean, the idea that the minute you step on a train, you're going to die from COVID was really put out by the government, and the train companies kind of went along with this. And, you know, there's this whole kind of panic instead of saying, look, these are pretty safe and they're reasonably well ventilated. And, you know, the risk is pretty low, as most of the research has subsequently shown. But this has helped stimulate the car-led COVID recovery. And it now needs, again, some marketing campaign and some recognition of the problems and a push in the other direction. And obviously, one of the ways would be through price mechanism. But as you know, they've done exactly the opposite. So bus and rail fares are going up. They only announced today that TfL is going to put them up by 4.8% along with the national rail fares. And well, as it happens, fuel is going up at the moment, but no thanks to any extra taxation.
No, indeed. Well, on the road pricing thing, Christian, your friend and mine, Claire Haig from Greener Transport Council, on this programme, she came forward with a very interesting road pricing idea, which was broadly you should have two systems running in parallel. So you'd introduce road pricing as an opt-in. And if you opted in, firstly, you'd get some money back through your tax system to compensate you for the fuel duty that you would otherwise be paying. You wouldn't pay vehicle excise duty, and you would pay as you go. And that would mean that quite a large number of people in more rural areas with little pollution and little congestion would be quids in on a pay-as-you-go basis. And if you then manage to get enough people into the pay-as-you-go pot by a series of fiscal changes on the existing system and on the opt-in system, you could start to then gnaw away at the suburbs of towns themselves, the outer sides of cities, till eventually you had so many people on the road pricing system, it wouldn't be politically toxic anymore, because for as long as it's opt-in, it's politically neutral. You either do or you don't, a bit like first and second class post.
But if you opt-in, you'd have to not have to pay the fuel tax anymore, or what?
Well, the idea would be you would, through the tax system, get a credit back for the fuel duty that it was calculated you'd pay. So they'd adjust your tax code or send, there'd be a mechanism to compensate you for the fuel you were also paying. But her argument was, we're trying to do this inside out. We should be starting with the relatively simpler areas where the multipliers of pollution are low, the multipliers of congestion are low, and you could get enough people in the system to give it credibility. And then you could start to fiddle with the prices so that eventually even the hardest ones, that's to say that people in those places where pollution is at its greatest and where congestion is at its greatest, would finally find it better to pay as you go. That would avoid the toxicity of the binary choice, either one thing or another, till eventually you just got a few diehards on the old system. I thought that was quite a good plan.
That's a reasonable plan. But, you know, Leon, it has to start further back than that, I think. And we have to convince politicians to begin to talk about it. And as you know, until we start talking about it and talking about the issue and combining it with the green sustainable agenda, we're not going to get anywhere. So you have to begin to soften up public opinion, and it has to be bipartisan. And the trouble is, we don't live in a bipartisan world at the moment, you know, just as in America. And, you know, we have to have an honest kind of discussion about it. And as I say, I can see the whiffs of that happening at the moment, but in no way kind of sufficiently to begin to turn the tide over it.
So the other one I was going to ask you about, Christian, because it's a while since you and I had the chance to talk together. You used to have a hair trigger that operated every time the word autonomous vehicles was used in any sentence. Now, since then, and since your wonderful book, The Road to Nowhere, there has been some
driverless cars on the road to nowhere.
Driverless cars on the road to nowhere.
The road to nowhere.
Since then, several generations of improvements have happened. So if you buy a new car now, lane keeping assist, dynamic cruise control, self-parking, elements of automation that are relative.
No, Leon. They're elements of driver aids. They are not elements of automation. And that's absolutely crucial. And at last, Tesla is beginning to be called out about its full self-driving kind of software, which is nothing of the sort. And don't be sucked into this, Leon, because getting people driver aids, which they can help them make it a bit easier to drive on a motorway or something, or possibly even lane change or whatever, is just a different dimension from actually autonomy. And that we have to bang, and people like you are very important in this, we have to bang that message across, because otherwise there's a real danger that a lot of people, as has happened in America, will get killed as a result of failure to understand the difference between them. And Leon, well, you know, you might think, oh, my book, I was the first edition was written 3 years ago, and then I revised it last year. If you think that any of that is out of date, you'd be mistaken. Everything I wrote in that has effectively still pertains today. And the crucial point being that we are nowhere near autonomy, that there's no business case has ever been shown to be viable for it, because the stuff is very expensive. And there has the technical aspects are nowhere near ready to do what would be level 4 or 5, which is essentially being able to drive a car in every condition, either geofenced level 4 or everywhere level 5. And Google, who are way ahead of this with through their company Waymo, have begun to accept that they can't quite envisage a world where there is actual full autonomy. And the implications of that are that the whole model that was put out by the driverless car lobby, which is that we'd all be in driverless cars that were shared use and electric, is simply not going to happen. And therefore, the implication of that is that then if we do have lots of driverless cars, there'll be more bloody cars on the road, because some of these will have nobody in them at all. And, you know, what benefit is that? So the whole model on which this has been predicated has actually fallen apart. And yet, what do I know? Waymo is worth £30 billion, apparently, or $30 billion, apparently, on the stock exchange. I mean, you know, what sense does that make? A company that hasn't produced a pound of reasonable revenue, apart from a few taxi fares in Phoenix, is worth $30 billion. Ah, you know, what explains that?
Well, I'm glad to see that your hair trigger is not diminished, even the passage of time. There are also some practical things which I'm fascinated about. And this is a party piece for an after-dinner speech or lecture, because it's about how we all behave in the wider world. So in a city of autonomous vehicles, am I going to press the button and wait patiently for the green man before crossing the road? Or am I going to step out in front of this autonomous vehicle, which will stop for anything? So how am I going to behave? Will traffic be able to function at all? What will happen?
No, well, as you know, in the book, I postulate the Holborn problem, which is that, you know, if you cycle through Holborn or drive through Holborn at kind of 6 o'clock in the evening, you'll see that after people are just flooding into the station and that they're just, you know, walking between the cars and the whole thing's at total gridlock. And of course, once they knew that, you know, they could stop any car by just walking in front of it, which you have to do because Asimov's rule of robotics, robots can't kill people. So they have to stop. So I don't wait for the Green Man anyway. I'm a traditionalist. The Green Man is indicative, not kind of required, as it is in.
But actually, Christian, you're on better legal ground, because actually common law gives you the right to pass and repass. It doesn't give you any rights to obstruct. So you are, in fact, on better legal grounds walking across, even if the light is not in your favour,
because you're
repassing. Whereas if you stand on the pavement waiting, you are causing obstruction. So you're on quite good legal ground.
I didn't know that, but that's very useful to know. I will tell my friends that. The whole point is that this is the killer point for driverless cars, because they can't get around this problem. That quite apart from the example I've often given in my numerous talks about this, and I'm always happy if any of your listeners want to hear my talk about driverless cars, I'm very happy to come and give it to conferences and the like. The key point is that once people realise that they can stop any car, bad people can stop the cars too. So, you wouldn't have a driverless car around the back ends of Johannesburg suburbs, would you? Because, any bad people could just step in front of it and do their business and rob the occupants. And so there's all these problems. What I don't understand, Leon, I've worked on this for about 5-6 years now, is the gullibility of people who take this on and invest in these companies when the end product is unviable. And Uber has discovered it wasn't. But Uber for a long time was saying our whole business model is about, eventually we won't have drivers. And I asked them a very early stage, I said, well, hold on a second, if you don't have drivers, you won't have owner drivers. And therefore, you'll have to buy the whole kit yourself, and it's going to be very expensive. How do you fund it? And won't that make things more expensive? Oh no, we just lease it and blah, blah. I said, oh yeah, who would you lease it off? None of it makes sense at all. I mean, Elon Musk actually claimed that by now, by 2022, that anybody who owned a Tesla could park it outside their house at night, and the car would go off to the nearest city, operate as a taxi overnight, and then kind of come back in the morning at 7 o'clock to ready to take them to work. Well, quite apart from that, nobody would want kind of drunk people vomiting in their Tesla overnight. The idea is completely technically eons away. And yet all these people just swallow this stuff. And I'm just a humble transport writer, kind of, looking at the evidence and trying to kind of put it forward. But somehow, I must be wrong, because I'm not a millionaire like they are.
So, Christian, we could have made four lunches out of today's subject. So just in our last couple of minutes, we've got something to celebrate, haven't we? We've got an integrated rail plan. I mean, everything is now sorted, isn't it? It is all absolutely sorted. The railways are broad.
You can't just allow 2 minutes. Just very briefly. I mean, the problem with the railways has been that there has been no kind of coherent strategic plan. And HS2 is not a coherent strategic plan. It's a kind of line that links certain places and has an awful lot of parkway stations and kind of very odd assortment of stations, with two in Birmingham, two in London, and nothing in between. And it's a kind of bugger's muddle. And, now suddenly we get something called an integrated rail plan, which actually is a slight improvement on the idea of just plonking down HS2. But it has not been sufficiently road tested or sufficiently analysed. But on the other hand, it does represent a commitment to investing in the railways, which I'm delighted by. And indeed, I think that some of it can be adapted and sorted out and worked on, and some quite workable things will come out of it, more coherent than the original HS2, but not really genuinely a plan. But again, we could talk about this one all the time. But all I can say is that I'm very pleased that this government, despite its shortage of money and everything, still sees the rail as having a big future and expanding. Now, whether it kind of actually puts its money down seriously and rescues TfL, rescues the other passenger transport authorities, and actually invests in some of the stuff that it's promising, that's another matter.
Christian, thank you. Well, believe it or not, we've had 40 minutes, which is a long lunch for you and I, because normally we have to do it quicker than that. It's been absolutely fascinating. And thank you ever so much for coming on this show. I know everybody's going to really, really enjoy this episode. I've been talking to Christian Woolmar. His book, Crossrail, The Whole Story, is published by Head of Zeus Limited. You can get it at all the usual outlets, Christian, or from Amazon. So thank you very much indeed. This has been Lunch with Leon. It's an itthub.net production. Please do go across to our website at itthub.net for all the latest transport news, also other podcasts, details of this one, details of other podcasts you can listen to, and our brilliant event at Farnborough coming up next May. So once again, Christian Walmar, noted author, new book available now on Crossrail, and as ever, an absolutely brilliant commentary on the modern transport scene. Christian, thanks very much.
Pleasure.